Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jack Cordes, president of Mellon Private Wealth Management of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dennis Ross, fellow at the Washington Institute, former U.S. Special Middle East Coordinator from 1988 to 2000, and author of Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. A scholar and highly skilled diplomat with more than two decades of experience in Soviet and Middle East policy, Ambassador Ross has worked closely with Secretaries of State James Baker, Warren Christopher, and Madeleine Albright. He has served as Special Middle East Coordinator under President Clinton and as a director of the State Department's Policy Planning Office in the first Bush administration. In that position, he played a prominent role in developing U.S. policy toward the former Soviet Union, the unification of Germany and its integration into NATO, arms control negotiations, and the development of the 1991 Gulf War Coalition. Ambassador Ross played a leading role in shaping U.S. involvement in the Middle East peace process and negotiated directly with the parties involved. He was this country's point person in both the George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton administrations and was instrumental in assisting Israelis and Palestinians in reaching the 1995 interim agreement. He also successfully brokered the Hebron Accord in 1997, facilitated the 1994 Israel-Jordan peace treaty, and intensively worked to bring Israel and Syria together. Since leaving government service in 1991, Mr. Ross has published in Foreign Policy and the National Interest. He also was a frequent contributor to the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and the New York Times. Please welcome Dennis Ross.
You know, I suppose I could quote Henny Youngman and say, I just flew in and boy, are my arms tired. I literally did just fly in. And unfortunately, this was probably a program also scheduled to begin at 6, right? Well, I was flying United Airlines and from San Diego. And even though I told them I had to be here, anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm going to talk about my book, which comes, I know, as a major surprise. I'm going to start by posing a question to you. When you hear the word statecraft, how many people here think they know what it means? I mean, there's either a combination of shyness or people actually don't know, yes? All right, so let me, since many of you think you know, and others are either reluctant to admit that you don't know or don't want to be quizzed, because I was tempted to begin to ask, yes, really? Let me pose a hypothetical. Let's assume that the next administration is an administration that is really good with what might be referred to as the tools of the trade. When most people think of statecraft, what do they think of? They think of diplomacy. They think of economic wherewithal. They think of coercive power, military power, hard power. They think of intelligence. They think of organizational skills. They think of informational capability, meaning how you frame issues so that others will accept what you're seeking to persuade them of. In other words, they think of all the tools that a state has to pursue its foreign policy. So let's pursue a question. If the next administration was really good at being able to organize and carry out all these tools, it was really good in terms of the art of diplomacy. I'm talking about the next administration. So let's assume the next administration actually knows how to conduct diplomacy. And it actually understands that it can use its economic resources as a form of leverage. And it understands how to use military power or even the threat of military power to affect the behavior of others. And it uses intelligence very well to reveal what are potential problems. And it also knows how to use public diplomacy, meaning the public side of being able to describe why an issue is a particular problem or a particular challenge. If that administration could do all those things and integrate the tools together, would it be good at statecraft? What do you think? Yes. Everybody thinks yes? Okay. Well, what happens if that administration, which could do everything I just described, was doing all those things but in the service of objectives that made no sense? Well, would the administration then be good at statecraft? No. So you better be able to shape objectives that make some sense, right? Okay, so what if this next administration turns out to be pretty good at analyzing the world as it is, understanding what the key priorities are that we face, defines our purposes the right way, shapes the objectives in terms of fitting what, in a sense, we need to be able to respond to? In other words, is very good at identifying our purpose and role in the world and identifies the right objectives based on the right priorities. Is it going to be good at statecraft? Maybe, yeah. Already you've begun to sort of become more cautious in terms of your assessments. Well, obviously it would only be good at statecraft if it actually knew how to implement the objectives. If it isn't very good at implementation, but it has all the right objectives, it's not going to be very good at statecraft. So what we already know from this discussion is that objectives and means, objectives and instruments, objectives and assets have to be married. Good statecraft marries objectives and means. Bad statecraft is always characterized by a huge gap between your objectives and your means. So how do you think we're doing today? Let's take Iraq. Is Iraq an example where we have a marriage of objectives and means? Even from the beginning, did we have a marriage of objectives and means? Can you imagine, for one second, that Iraq actually had weapons of mass destruction? I mean, that was the objective of the administration, wasn't it? The objective of the administration was to basically go in and take care of the weapons of mass destruction. Well, humor me, all right? Humor me and assume that when the administration said it cared about weapons of mass destruction, it actually cared about weapons of mass destruction. If that was the objective, we didn't have means that were appropriate to the objective. Why? Because we didn't have the capability in terms of forces to go in and even seize control of all the over 900 sites the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, had identified as being what they thought were weapons of mass destruction sites. So even if they'd had weapons of mass destruction, we were in trouble because we didn't have enough forces to be able to go in and seize them. Not to mention, we certainly didn't have the forces to be able to go and protect the borders to ensure that if they were there, they weren't smuggled out. So I could say, thank your lucky stars that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, because we didn't have the means to fulfill that objective. So even from the beginning, there was a gap between our objectives and our means. Why do you think that was the case? All right, I'll answer that question. I know you're surprised that I'll answer that question. We didn't have the means because we shaped an objective, and we shaped our means, both. Our objectives and our means were shaped by a faith-based assessment, not a reality-based assessment. Our assessments were governed by wishful thinking. They weren't governed by reality. That's what I mean by faith-based. I'm not talking about religion right now. I'm talking about faith-based. You look at reality the way you would like it to be as opposed to the way it is. Now, statecraft is never going to marry objectives and means if it's based on faith-based assessments. Why were we so off in Iraq? Because the assessment was based on an assumption. The assumption was when Saddam Hussein falls, everything falls into place, it doesn't fall apart. Well, what a surprise we didn't have the means. If everything was going to fall into place, Why do we need more forces? The Secretary of Defense, to prove he was planning on that basis, he was planning to draw down from 160,000 troops to 25,000 troops in 3.5 months. Well, you can't be making that kind of an assumption unless your assessment is everything falls into place. It doesn't fall apart. Was it unknowable to look at the situation in Iraq and think we might face an insurgency? Was it unknowable to think that we might face sectarian warfare? Was it unknowable to think that when Saddam Hussein fell or was removed or disappeared, that there would be a vacuum? And in the Middle East, vacuums are always, without exception, filled by violence. Were all those unknowable? Yes, that's a rhetorical question stated in an overly dramatic way to make a point. That's true. None of it was unknowable. Why? Again, I answer my own questions really well. Probably because I've thought about them. Not to mention, I've written about it in the book, so of course I have an answer to this. None of it was unknowable. The Sunnis had dominated Iraq for 400 years. Do you think that they were ready to simply roll over and accept the Shia dominating them? Not a chance. So an insurgency wasn't not only unknowable, an insurgency was a given. Was it unknowable about the Shia-Sunni divide? If the Sunnis had dominated for 400 years and weren't simply prepared to accept Shia dominance, don't you think the Shia kind of got that too? Didn't the Shia view themselves as a majority who were entitled to finally get their due? Look, fast forward to today. What is the fundamental problem we face in Iraq today? The fundamental problem we face in Iraq today remains what it was at the beginning. The Shia are a majority who have been basically oppressed for a very long time, made far more acute their oppression, at least, during the Saddam period. They were always in a subservient position, but they weren't an underclass the way they became during Saddam's time. So they have a mindset that reflects they're a majority that is entitled to rule because they're a majority, but they're a majority who fear they can lose power at any moment. So they don't share power because they fear it'll be taken away from them. Is it a surprise that when the president announced the surge and he said he had 9 promises from Prime Minister Maliki, Prime Minister Maliki said to him, and this is the reason he was doing the surge, because the surge wasn't an end in itself, it was a means. It wasn't an objective, it was a means. What's statecraft about? Objectives and means. This was a means. It was a means to create an environment where security would be good enough in Baghdad that the leaders of all the different sectarian groups would be prepared to forge compromises on political issues. And what were the promises the Prime Minister made to him? Well, he would provide forces to match the forces we need. Take a look at the fighting in Diyala province or Bakuba right now. Who does the lion's share of the fighting? We go in, 2,500 American troops go in, and they're backed in the rear by 500 Iraqi troops. So have they furnished the forces they said they would furnish? This actually is one of the few promises they made that at least they've made some effort to pursue. Look at all the political promises that were part of this list of 9. I testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Senator McCain at one point said to me, well, can you identify what the benchmark should be that we should hold the Iraqi government to? I said, sure. Just take the promises that President Bush listed the day he announced the surge. They will provide for forces, have they? They will produce an oil revenue sharing bill, and they will implement it. They haven't. They will, in fact, rehabilitate the Ba'ath party members so that they can serve again in government. They haven't. They will provide $10 billion in reconstruction monies, and those monies will go for the first time to the Sunni areas. They haven't. They will produce a fair process for reforming the Constitution. They haven't. They will make sure that when force is used, it's used equally against all groups with no sectarian or political considerations intruding. Well, they've observed that one, I would say, in the breach. They will empower people at the local level by having elections for provincial governors. They haven't. Is any of this a surprise? No. Any more than it was no surprise that you faced an insurgency at the outset. A reality-based assessment would have revealed what we were getting into. It's really pretty remarkable that you would think about committing forces without having it governed by a reality-based assessment. That should be a sine qua non for statecraft always, but certainly when you're thinking about using hard power. We had a faith-based assessment. So what's statecraft about? Statecraft is about identifying objectives and making sure you have means or you can mobilize the means from others to fit your objectives. It's about having reality-based assessments, not faith-based assessments. It's about being able to understand the situations you're in, the challenges you face, the vulnerabilities of your adversaries, because a key to statecraft is leverage and knowing how to exercise leverage, just as it's a key to negotiations. This is a book that originally, when I was writing it, was going to be a book on negotiations. For those of you who remember my first book called The Missing Piece, it was a large book, unlike The Missing Piece. This book, you do not get a hernia when you lift it. Now, you also don't get your aerobics in when you carry it, like with The Missing Piece. But the story of The Missing Piece was not just a story of trying to understand what it took to try to negotiate peace and make peace in the Middle East and why, in the end, it was missing. Interspersed throughout it was an awful lot about the logic, the rhythm, the character of negotiation. So I was going to write a book where I was going to do something novel. Most of the literature on negotiations has been written by people who actually never negotiated. So I thought, well, maybe I should do something unusual and actually write about negotiations from the perspective of a practitioner. And that is what I was going to do. Until I looked at the absence of statecraft, looked at what was going on in terms of our foreign policy, and said, no, I have something else I need to do. So this is a book that explains what statecraft is, has historical chapters that show statecraft in action, meaning when it was done well, and also when it was not done well, Iraq being the case that is written that becomes a poster child for how not to do statecraft. And then I, of course, wanted to say, all right, so what's the nature of the international landscape that we face today? What are some of the new challenges that require maybe different tools or more imaginative uses of statecraft? And then I do have four chapters on negotiations and mediation, the what, when, why you negotiate, and then 12 rules for how you negotiate, and the what, when, why you mediate, and 11 rules for how you mediate. And I couldn't end it there. I then had to say, okay, so I've told you what it is. I've shown it in practice in the past. I've shown what is good statecraft. I've shown the elements. I've talked about the tools because negotiations are central to every form of statecraft. War is a form of statecraft. It is. It's a form of statecraft. You want to bring war to an end? How do you do it? Well, usually negotiations are involved. You want to prevent war? How do you do it? Well, usually negotiations are involved. You want to make peace? How do you do it? Well, usually you have to negotiate. You want to end the conflict? You negotiate. You want to build leverage, a coalition, either to fight a war or to use coercion or deterrence so you don't have to? Well, you have to negotiate. So every element of statecraft in one form or another involves the use of negotiation. But that wasn't enough just to do that. So I applied it to four cases. What to do in the Israeli-Palestinian case, because I'm congenitally incapable of not addressing that issue. How to contend with radical Islam, because this is, you know, when you hear the words war on terror, do you think there's a war on terror? What is terror? Is terror an ideology? No, terror is an instrument. We have a war with radical Islam. So I have a chapter in there on, again, from a statecraft perspective, on how we should contend with the radical Islam, IS. And I have a chapter on Iran. And then I have a chapter on the rise of China. So this is a book that basically is designed to bring to life not only what statecraft is, but also how to do it. It's a book about what I would describe as the what of foreign policy, meaning what our foreign policy ought to be, what our role in the world ought to be, how we define what our objectives should be, and then how we actually act on them. How do you think we're doing on Iran? Do you think that we have a natural fit here of objectives and means? Why don't we take a little closer look at Iran? If we were going to apply a statecraft approach to Iran today, the first thing we'd have to do is do a realistic assessment of the lay of the land. We know what our objective is. Our objective is to prevent Iran from going nuclear. Now, how should we frame that issue? Framing is very important, because if you frame issues effectively, others are going to identify with your purpose, with your objective. If you basically say, we're right, and join us, well, you're probably not going to persuade too many people. Or if you basically say, this is a big problem, and therefore join us, well, you're probably also not going to persuade too many people. Right now, the administration, the president has said, Iran with nuclear weapons is destabilizing. Are you persuaded? But what if we were to frame the issue in the following way? What if we were to say that if Iran goes nuclear, we're going to have a nuclear Middle East? Because if Iran goes nuclear, Saudi Arabia will go nuclear. Saudi Arabia looks at Iran with nuclear weapons as almost as profound a threat as the Israelis do. Because Iran with nuclear weapons will have a nuclear shield behind which to engage in coercion and subversion. And there is a Sunni-Shia divide that, thanks to the war in Iraq, everybody in the Middle East is pretty focused on, and the Saudis in particular, and for a good reason. 20% of their population is Shia, and guess where that Shia population is located? In the oil provinces in Saudi Arabia. So an Iran with nuclear weapons that has a shield behind which it can engage in coercion and subversion is a profound threat to Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis, from their standpoint, their attitude is, they go nuclear, we will too. And, you know, don't take my word for it. You know, a couple of months ago, the Saudi foreign minister announced the Saudis were now interested in nuclear power. Now, just to put this in some perspective, while the Iranians may have reserves of oil and natural gas that are significant, they pale in comparison to what the Saudis have. The Saudis have the largest reserves in the world, by far. So when they talk about nuclear power, suddenly they use the exact same words the Iranians are using. Because if Iran goes nuclear, they will too. Odds are they already have a deal with Pakistan and AQ Khan. Now, if Saudi Arabia is nuclear, you think that Egypt's going to say, it's okay, we'll let the Saudis be the only Arab country that has nuclear weapons? That was also a rhetorical question. A couple of months ago, a very senior Egyptian official said to me, if Iran goes nuclear, it's the end of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. This is a regime that has existed since 1968. Whatever its flaws, the fact of the matter is, we only have 8 or 9 countries that are nuclear powers today. The projections at the time of the NPT when it was adopted was that within 15 years, we'd probably have 20 or 30 nuclear countries. The fact is, this regime has basically worked. And what we don't want to see is the prohibitions that it represents on the world stage removed. And Iran with nuclear weapons means we have a nuclear Middle East, and it means we have 20 to 30 countries in the world that are nuclear weapon states. It means we have a world where states operate on much more of a hair trigger. It means we have a world that is vastly less predictable. It means one of the international regimes that has worked is gone. Now, that's the way to frame the issue of Iran with nuclear weapons, because it might also have some impact on the Europeans, who believe very much in international regimes. All right, so that's how we should frame the issue. All right, what about the realistic understanding of what's going on in Iran itself? Well, Iran basically has 3 constituencies in its elite. I'm talking only about the elite, not about the Iranian public. 1 constituency are the Revolutionary Guards. They are the keepers of the Khomeini flame. They are the keepers of wanting to spread the Khomeini revolution. They believe in confrontation. They run the nuclear program. We are not going to dissuade them. But they're not necessarily decisive. Bear in mind, you recall when the British sailors were seized, it was the Revolutionary Guard that seized the British sailors. They released them after 14 days because Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader in Iran, not a title we have in this country, but it's a title they have there. He and the council he set up for decision-making told them to release him. So what it tells you is the Revolutionary Guard are significant but not decisive. There are other constituencies in the leadership. And even though all of those constituencies want nuclear weapons, because the mullahs who represent probably the most important constituency, and Rafsanjani, the former president, is their standard bearer, and the liberalizers, who want to open the system but don't want to revolutionize it, and Khatami, former president, is their emblem. The nuclear program was pursued quite energetically when they were presidents. This is not just Ahmadinejad, who really is the standard bearer of the Revolutionary Guard. The whole elite wants nuclear weapons. The difference is not all of the elite wants nuclear weapons at any price. And our issue here is to recognize that there are those who don't want it at any price, and the proof of it is they have a debate. We've seen it. The debate didn't start when we were offering incentives. A year ago, the British, the French, and the Germans offered an inducement package. If the Iranians like to say, we only want nuclear power for civil purposes. Now, if that's the case, how come when they were offered a year ago, light water reactors, which are really good at generating electricity and power and really bad at generating fissile material, the Iranians said no, and it didn't trigger a debate. A debate was triggered that emerged in the public, in the elite, once we began to talk about sanctions, starting last October. That's when we began to see a very public debate. It became more pronounced when the first resolution, Security Council resolution, was adopted on December 23rd. We've seen a debate emerge which demonstrates there's a potential to change Iranian behavior. The problem we face today is that the price, the notion of the price, is not all that clear-cut. So that those who are hesitant about the price aren't prepared to change the course on the Iranian side. We have a mismatch. We have slow-motion diplomacy at the Security Council. We have fast-paced nuclear development by the Iranians. And here again, don't take my word for it. The head of the IAEA, Dr. Mohammad Al-Baradei, has said by the end of the year, Iran will have 8,000 centrifuges operating. With 3,000 centrifuges operating full-time, you produce enough fissile material for one nuclear weapon in 9 months. If you add 8,000 operating full-time, do the math. You're talking about being able to produce at least three a year. So what we have is fast-paced nuclear development, slow-motion diplomacy, a mismatch of objectives and means. Is it impossible to bring them into sync? Is it impossible to play upon the vulnerabilities that the Iranian leadership fears or feels? If they felt so strong, they wouldn't be arresting Iranian Americans, none of whom, by the way, are interested in subverting Iran, all in engaging. If they felt so strong, they wouldn't be worried about where their economy is. I mean, they have had a windfall in revenues for the last 4 years because the price of oil went from $27 a barrel in March of 2003 to $69 a barrel today. Notwithstanding that, they have high inflation, high unemployment. They have a plummeting stock market. They have declining oil and natural gas output, which is the key to their revenues. 90% of their revenues come from their exports of oil and natural gas. They can't keep producing it because the infrastructure is too antiquated. They need massive investment from the outside, lots of technology transfer, all sorts of credits. Otherwise, the economy goes downhill, and they lose the subsidies, which in the minds of the mullahs preserves the social tranquility on the inside. So they have vulnerabilities. Today, they began rationing gasoline in Iran. They have no shortage of oil, but they don't have refinery capacity. They have to basically bring in about half of their gasoline. So they have vulnerabilities, and the debate reflects the awareness of that on the part of important parts of the elite. So what I'm laying out for you is, A, they have vulnerabilities. B, their public debate indicates that they're aware of those vulnerabilities. C, the Revolutionary Guard, who were not going to dissuade, when they did something like seize the British sailors, they couldn't, in fact, sustain it, and a decision was imposed on them. So we have the potential to change their behavior, but we haven't done it yet. So what do we need to do? We need to do at least three things. Again, following the logic of statecraft, we have an objective. We have to understand what are the means that are available to play upon the Iranian vulnerabilities that don't require the use of force, which I would suggest to you is not a wonderful option. But an Iran with nuclear weapons is an unacceptable outcome. So what do we do? Well, I'll give you three means that could be employed today that would change this mismatch of slow-motion diplomacy and fast-paced nuclear development. I mentioned the Saudis. I mentioned what their stakes were. I said they'll go nuclear to counteract the Iranian nuclear program, but it's much better for them not to. Now, the Saudis have enormous leverage on those who hold the key to the Iranian economic lifeline, which is the key to affecting the Iranian behavior. And who holds the key to the Iranian economic lifeline? The Europeans. Last year alone, the Europeans provided $18 billion in loan guarantees, credit guarantees, for their companies doing business with Iran. You want to cut the economic lifeline, meaning you want to cut access to credits, cut technology transfer, cut investment from the outside, and cut off the Iranian banks. You want to do that? The key to doing that are the Europeans. All right, so the first way to affect the Europeans is to go to the Saudis. We're talking about a new arms deal with the Saudis, which I don't necessarily oppose, but is a new arms deal with the Saudis going to affect Iranian behavior? No. But if the Saudis decided they were going to use their financial leverage in Europe, where their holdings are enormous, I'll underscore the word huge, what if we coordinated with them and said, all right, let's pool our means, let's pool our forms of leverage. Let's focus on the big investment houses, let's focus on the big banks, let's go to the governments. And in the case of the Saudis, you can say, you want our holdings, you want our investment here? We'll then cut off the Iranians, because your economic stakes in us dwarf any stakes you have in Iran. All right, so that's one way to get the Europeans to change their behavior, to ratchet up the pressure on the Iranians. A second way, get the Israelis quietly to go to the Europeans. The Europeans fear the use of force more than they fear an Iran with nuclear weapons. I'll repeat that. They fear the use of force against Iran more than they fear an Iran with nuclear weapons. So from their standpoint, in the end, they're prepared to live with an Iran with nuclear weapons. Now, if Israel goes to the key Europeans, and the key Europeans in this case happen to be the Germans and the Italians, and the Israelis say to them, you don't want to see the force, you don't want to see force used against Iran, but your current path makes force more likely than not, because you think you can live in the end with an Iran with nuclear weapons, and we can't, not because we don't want to, but because Iran won't let us live. Week before last, what did Ahmadinejad say? He said, the countdown to the destruction of the Zionist regime is close at hand. That's what he said. You think the Israelis are going to say, oh, those are just words? When these guys are developing the means to act on those words? If the Israelis say to the Europeans, you're making your current path, unless you ratchet up the economic pressure, you're making the use of force more likely, not less likely, that's a second way to affect the European calculus. So here's two ways. Now I'm going to give you a third way. I could give you more, but I'm just going to give you three. You have to read the book, actually. There's a chapter on this in the book. What do you think? I just thought of this right now. Third way is for us to do something that relates, again, to the essential logic of leverage and negotiations. The Europeans have been reluctant to ratchet up the pressure for two reasons. One, there are financial interests and stakes, although, as I said, they're dwarfed by their stakes in Saudi Arabia. The other is they're worried about a slippery slope to confrontation. So it's not an easy thing for them to do. So you get the Saudis to do this, it will concentrate their minds. You get the Israelis to do it, it will concentrate their minds. But you need us, too. The Europeans believe that you have to negotiate with the Iranians to produce an end to this. And they believe no negotiation, no deal in the end is possible unless the U.S. is at the table. Because the fact of the matter is, what the Iranians want isn't just economic benefits or political benefits. They want security assurances from us. They read us. There's a whole historical narrative here. It goes back to Mossadegh. They see us as determined to deny them their destiny and to subvert the regime. Now, you could say they're paranoid. You could say they're governed by conspiracy. But as Henry Kissinger once said, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not coming after you. You take them for who they are. That's, again, a reality-based assessment. You need the U.S. at the table in the eyes of the Europeans. Now, you're asking the Europeans to do something that's not easy for them. which is to say, all right, we're going to cut the economic lifeline. We're going to ratchet up the economic pressures on Iran now. So when you're asking them to do something hard, the logic of negotiations, the logic of statecraft is you say, okay, we'll do something you want at the same time. We'll join you in the negotiations. Now understand, I am not in favor of having us join them in the negotiations if we impose no conditions at all. We have a current condition right now. We've had it for the last year. The current condition is that Iran should suspend its uranium enrichment. And when they do, we'll join the talks. For the last year, we've had that as a condition, and it hasn't worked. And I can tell you, because I actually do speak to all the Europeans who are actually involved with the negotiations with the Iranians, they want us to drop that condition. It's not just that the Iranians want us to. It's not just that Dr. Al-Baradei has announced he wants us to. It's that the Europeans who are doing the negotiations want us to drop the condition. If we just dropped the condition and did nothing else, the message to the Iranians would be, boy, do they need us. We don't have to concede a thing. Let's put it this way. I was able to restrain my enthusiasm when the Secretary of State, the week before the Sharm el-Sheikh conference on Iraq, announced more than once publicly she really hoped the Iranian foreign minister would come. At the time, the Iranians said we're coming. They were equivocating on the level. Why did we care about what the level was? When she said, we really hope publicly you're going to come, the message they heard was, boy, do they need us. When you go into a negotiation, the message you send is, you need us. The message you don't want to send is, we need you. Ahmadinejad said later on that we had approached the Iranians 41 times to come. Well, color me silly, but, you know, I'll do it once. 41 times? It makes me look desperate. If we drop the condition on uranium enrichment, which I'm prepared to do, you have to do something at the same time. So the Iranians don't get the false impression. But you're also, as I said, putting it in a context with the Europeans. We'll do what you want on negotiations. We're prepared to reach a deal. But if you want to reach a deal, our chances of reaching a deal are much greater if you concentrate the Iranian minds. What's the essence of what I'm saying? And this comes to the heart of what statecraft is all about. Oftentimes, with certain regimes, you have to concentrate their mind, show them what they'll lose. But at the same time you show them what they're going to lose, you have to show them the door with the pathway to what they can gain. In the case of the Iranians, you will not induce the Iranians to give up their nuclear weapons because there's no combination of inducements that are as meaningful, as powerful to them as nuclear weapons. But you can show them that the price isn't worth it, that the cost is too high, and then get them to think, okay, if the cost is too high, what can I get for giving it up? It isn't impossible to employ statecraft towards Iran now to get them to stop the nuclear weapons program, but the problem is we're running out of time. The clock is ticking. We don't have a lot of time left, given the pace of their efforts. Statecraft often requires patience, but there are times when it requires a sense of urgency. So why did I write this book? I wrote this book fundamentally because as we look to the election, as we look to the next administration, first, I was worried about the legacy that this administration is leaving. It has three legacies it's leaving right now. One legacy is our resources are going to be strained to the bone, especially our hard power resources. When Colin Powell says the army is broken, you know you got a problem. Secondly, we're going to have a legacy in terms of policies. The next administration is going to inherit Iraq. We can talk about Iraq in the Q&A. Assuming that you've asked about that. Third legacy is a sociology. Every administration has the political people who come in and then the ongoing bureaucracy. For the last, what will be 8 years, you've had people getting accustomed to how you make decisions and how you act on them. And that's been characterized by a non-statecraft approach. We have to reintroduce statecraft into the way we make foreign policy. Now, partly I'm gearing it towards the people who will be making decisions and making appointments so that they think about, again, introducing statecraft as a concept. But I also want the term. I start off by asking you, do you know what statecraft is? I want the term not to be an abstraction. I want the word not to be a slogan. I want those who are running for the presidency at some point during the course of the debate when we don't have 20 candidates. I want them to be able to be asked questions that show they get it. So you can help make that a reality by talking about this. I want to create a certain buzz about the word and about the concept so that it isn't, as I said, a slogan or an abstraction. So I'm counting on you. Yeah, first I want you to read the book. But I'm counting on you to talk about it too, because in the end, it will make a contribution to those who, in fact, are going to have to be conducting foreign policy in the next administration. And I can tell you, the subtitle of the book is How You Restore America's Standing in the World. We can't afford not to do it any longer. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dennis Ross for his comments this afternoon. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be conducting tonight's audience question period. Mr. Ross, as you can tell, we have a lot of questions, and yes, there are quite a few questions on Iraq, which we will get to shortly. Let's leave the present and the immediate past just for a second and go back to something that I read about yourself, some of the writings that you had about statecraft and Machiavelli and Plato. You indicated in a writing that I saw that Plato and Machiavelli were early practitioners of statecraft. Plato wrote about it. Machiavelli practiced it. I've usually thought about Machiavelli and have heard about Machiavelli in pejorative terms. Why is he such a good example of practicing statecraft?
Well, this shows that you read the preface of the book, because that's in the preface of the book.
Thank you.
We will have a quiz later on the book. Machiavelli has become a kind of descriptive term to describe maneuvering in policy, that one is sort of Machiavelli in terms of how they approach things. But that's a kind of, you know, that's a kind of simplistic approach to Machiavelli. Machiavelli basically looked at what are the instruments that you had, in a sense, as a representative of the state, and how could you use those instruments to pursue the interests of the state? You know, how you orchestrate them, how you integrate them, how you manipulate them, well, those are forms of statecraft. That doesn't have to be a negative. The terminology, the way he's described, may be seen as negative, but the fact is, what he understood is that you could sometimes maximize your power or protect your interests if you engaged in the ability to influence others by using the tools that were at your disposal. Sometimes he did it by convincing others that their interest was the same as his, but that then built leverage towards others. That's why I say he practiced statecraft, or at least theorized about it. I really said that Plato wrote about it, and he theorized about it, and I said Bismarck is the one who really practiced it, because Bismarck really did integrate all the tools. Machiavelli integrates less the tools, and he writes more about the tools.
Well, thanks for the history lesson. I think it's great to get that kind of a background. In your remarks, you talked about hard power and soft power. I assume the use of the military is an example of hard power. And here's a question about that. Has the U.S. proven that the threat of military power, our threat of military power is not very powerful in the future? If so, will adversaries be empowered? What options will we have then?
That is a really excellent question. After Vietnam, the Vietnam syndrome characterized us. After Iraq, will Iraq be characterized by an Iraqi syndrome? Will we be less able to use power or threaten the use of power? You know, with certain countries or with radical Islamists, we are not going to defeat radical Islamists only with a military strategy. But to think that the military isn't an important instrument to use with them is also simply unrealistic and naive. So we have to be able to use power, hard power. We have to be able to threaten hard power, and it has to be credible when we do it. One of the reasons the next administration is going to have to be able to present itself in a way that is compelling to the world is to show that it is capable of defining our interests, characterizing our objectives and acting on them in a way that includes all the tools at our disposal. You know, I say in the book that I quoted Jack Kennedy, President Jack Kennedy, about the issue of negotiations, that we should never fear to negotiate, but we should ever negotiate out of fear. And, you know, the key here is also the same with the issue of the of hard power. You have to be able to have the instrument. You have to be able to employ it. You have to be believed if you're prepared to threaten it. The more you're believed, the less you have to use it. So we're at a point now where I'm not sure we're so believed. If you look at the Iranians look at this administration, and even though I said they want security assurances because of the way they perceive the U.S., the fact of the matter is they think we're tied down in Iraq. So if we're so tied down in Iraq, how capable are we of actually doing anything against them militarily? In some ways, you need to have an administration that is freed of the constraints. Look, when you have a president who has a 26% approval rating, you think that isn't understood in the rest of the world? So a new administration that comes in and is able to command support of the public will also be perceived differently in the rest of the world as it relates even to hard power.
Well, regarding the next administration that you've just referred to and also in your prepared remarks, is the next president of the United States apt to be more or less engaged in the Middle East peace process, more or less engaged than George W. Bush?
I'm smiling only because I have several really clever quips I could make. But I'm also thinking about how my wife would respond if I were to make them. So it's impossible for the next president to be less engaged than President Bush has been. That's just a fact. I mean, we need a president. The president doesn't have to be the lead negotiator. But the president has to understand enough about these issues to be able to talk about them in a way that is convincing to those in the region that shows he understands them, and therefore he's engaged in them, and therefore he's invested in them. This administration has not invested in these issues. The proof of investment would be not only the character of engagement on a more intensive basis, it would also be a more consistent and intelligent way to talk about it. Now, the fact that we are now promoting Tony Blair to be the envoy, what does that say? Don't get me wrong. I think the world of Tony Blair. But this is one more kind of way of avoiding our responsibility, one more way of trying to get by in the cheap. Let somebody else do it. I write a biweekly column for the New Republic Online, and the main virtue of sitting in an airport for 2.5 hours is that I wrote my column for next week. And the issue is on this. It's on Tony Blair. I can get into what he will need to be effective, including the kind of mandate. But I'll tell you, one of the things that I find somewhat troubling is to give him the kind of mandate that he needs, so it's comprehensive, so it deals with all the issues, it also means basically you have to give him a free hand. Now, do we want to set that precedent for the future where suddenly we will not only contract out our policies, but we'll be entirely beholden to those that we contract them out to? You think that the next administration is going to want to come in having that precedent been established? I'm torn. I'm torn because I can tell you, I don't believe that this administration will do what is necessary right now. To understand the Israeli-Palestinian issue today, you have to understand that the core objective is not a political horizon. Let's go back to statecraft. What is statecraft about? Having clear objectives that are guided by reality. You can be ambitious. You can want to change the reality, but you can't change it before you understand it. In the case that we're dealing with now, we have two Palestinian regimes. They represent two completely different kinds of mindsets. They represent two different, not ideologies, but identities for the Palestinians. Are they going to be an Islamist group governed by Sharia, meaning that we will have a religious conflict, which we cannot solve, cannot settle? Or will they continue to be a national secular group where we have a national conflict, which may not be easy to settle, but at least it's possible to settle? The crux of the issue today, the crux of our objective today has to be, How do you manage the competition between Fatah and Hamas so that Hamas doesn't take over all the political institutions of Palestinian life? Now, you won't succeed by simply saying, well, we're going to support Abu Mazen. Let's go throw money at it. Let's support Abu Mazen. Because the reason Fatah has a problem today is because they've been completely corrupt and completely non-responsive to the Palestinian people. So if you're simply going to embrace Abu Mazen, and he's not going to deal with the old guard of Fatah, which is the cause of the problem, then you guarantee that what's going to happen is that Hamas will win. 3.5 weeks ago, I spent a few days in the West Bank, and I met over 30 Palestinians representing the old guard of Fatah, the young guard of Fatah, who aren't so young, the third generation of Fatah, and the fourth generation of Fatah. The third and fourth generation are basically 25 to 40. The young guard is basically 40 to 50, and the old guard are in their 70s. The old guard doesn't want to give up power. They don't want to change. Even now, when I saw those I was dealing with, the handwriting was on the wall about what was going to happen in Gaza. It hadn't collapsed yet. I came back after that. I wrote an article in the Washington Post called Hamastan, before, in fact, suddenly we had Hamastan, because the handwriting was on the wall. The Palestinians that I was seeing were saying, if we don't change, and these were Fatah people, but they were the younger ones, if we don't change, then Hamas will take over in the West Bank too. The only reason that they're not stronger than we are today in the West Bank is because the Israelis keep them weaker, because they've arrested their leadership. Our future can't be defined by the Israelis taking care of Hamas. We have to compete. Now, that's an important mindset. Our focus, our objective has to be, how do we help empower them based on the premise they're prepared to do something for themselves? Is this the time to be focused on a political horizon, which is still the objective of the administration? A political horizon that will deal with the contours of a permanent status deal where you have to make the core concessions on Jerusalem, refugees, and borders? We have a prime minister of Israel with a 2% approval rating, which is within the margin of error of the polls. We have two different Palestinian regimes. If you had a political horizon today, you'd have two fundamental problems. The first is, if it's disconnected from the realities on the day-to-day, no one will believe it on the Palestinian side. They'll say, well, if you can't change the day-to-day realities for us, we're supposed to believe you're going to solve Jerusalem? And I'm not making up that question, by the way. And even if you came up with a plan, it's very clear no one could implement it anytime soon. What we don't need from this administration is one more very ambitious transformational objective in the Middle East that will be revealed as hollow very quickly. That's not statecraft. That's not the exercise of statecraft. If I could only get a little bit passionate on the subject, I would be fine. Anyway, my long-winded answer to the question is that right now, when it comes to what the next administration should be, they have to be prepared to invest in this issue. They have to be prepared. The president doesn't have to live and breathe it every day, but the president has to know enough about it to be convincing, and then the secretary of state has to be involved enough where you don't take a trip once a month where every time you go out there, your objective is different. You build a strategy that's based on a cumulative approach. If it's rooted in a reality-based assessment, your objective doesn't change every month. And right now, our objective should be clear. What I worry about is that this administration won't do what is necessary. So even though I'm concerned that the kind of mandate that Tony Blair needs is one that may set a precedent that we may not be so thrilled about come the next administration, given the consequence of not doing what is necessary to deal with the core objective, I prefer to see Tony Blair be empowered, because he brings a passion and intelligence and interest, a commitment, plus a knowledge of how to mediate. I mean, bear in mind, this administration doesn't mediate. Think about it. Can you think of any place in the world where we play a prominent role as a mediator? By the way, I say the subtitle of the book is "And How to Restore America's Standing in the World." One of the things we do to change our image is show we're prepared to mediate conflicts, which demonstrate an American commitment to doing what others think is the right thing. Not such a bad way to proceed in foreign policy.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Dennis Ross, who is discussing how America can restore its standing in the world. Mr. Ross, I read where you indicated that you would like to see humanitarian assistance continue to Hamas. And the question here is, if that does happen, what assurances do we have, or whoever is continuing this this assistance for humanitarian purposes, what assurances do we have that the money will go for that purpose and not for weapons?
Well, what I said was, what I wrote was, we need to ensure that humanitarian assistance to Gaza is not conditioned. I didn't say we need to give humanitarian assistance to Hamas. The way you can transmit humanitarian assistance to Gaza is to use the UN, the Red Cross, NGOs. We cannot allow starvation in Gaza. It's morally wrong, and we can't do that. But if Hamas wants to get help, Hamas, now understand, Hamas is responsible in Gaza. They can't blame it on Fatah because they vanquished Fatah. They can't blame it on the Israelis because the Israelis aren't there. And by the way, the Israelis provide the electricity and water there. How long should Israel provide electricity and water to Gaza if there's going to be rockets fired from Gaza into Israel? I mean, it's an open question. If Hamas wants developmental assistance, not humanitarian assistance, if it wants investment, and they have to show they can govern now, well, then they have to play by the rules. Here's another example where there's actually leverage on Hamas. When Hamas wasn't responsible, there was less leverage on them. Now when they're responsible and they have to show they can govern, there's more leverage on them. So this is not a situation where we should be giving up the leverage, but you can't play with humanitarian assistance. That discredits us, and it's wrong. But beyond humanitarian assistance, if Hamas wants anything, then they're going to have to change their behavior.
You asked the question in your prepared remarks, how are we doing in Iran? Indicated that Iran is economically very vulnerable. The question is, the use of leverage in affecting the price of oil. Shouldn't the United States be using every tool at our disposal to help bring down oil prices? This would include conservation, alternative energy, including atomic power, green energy, etc.
Well, the answer is yes. I mean, the issue of energy is not only a question of global warming. It's a question of national security. It is absolutely incomprehensible that we should put ourselves in a position where basically you don't develop alternatives to this and you allow the Chavezes of the world, the Ahmadinejads of the world, and I would say even the Putins of the world, to be far more powerful because they have everybody literally over a barrel. I mean, it is completely nonsensical from the standpoint of national security. Now, it's probably we're not livable if we don't do something when it comes to global warming. But the fact is, just from a national security standpoint, we should be promoting all these alternatives. Now, by the way, that may not mean that you push for a lowering of the price. What it means is you may want to raise the price so you produce conservation and you put the monies that you, you know, if you're going to have some kind of carbon tax, you use that to create predictability, so you increase investment. You use that to create standards and controls and limitations in conservation, and you use that to put monies into alternative energy forms. But again, in answer to the question, from a national security standpoint, this should be a no-brainer, which I describe as, in diplomatic terms, as something that's obvious.
Mr. Ross, in terms of our objectives in Iraq, have our objectives been modified in Iraq? Are we now willing to settle for a face-saving victory and not a total victory?
Well, I don't know what the administration's objectives are. I don't think they've spelled them out because they still say they want an outcome in Iraq that they can't achieve. What we should be doing, and I think this is an issue for candidates, what we should be doing right now is we should be saying, all right, look, we can't achieve the best, let's prevent the worst. We have to be clear on what our objective should be in Iraq today. Our objective in Iraq today should basically be to make sure what's going on in Iraq doesn't leave Iraq. It's what one might describe as the Las Vegas rules for Iraq. What goes on in Iraq needs to stay in Iraq. And I mean it from two different standpoints. One is a sectarian conflict that doesn't spread to the outside and convulse the whole region. And the other is we don't even know who the Osama bin Laden of this war is going to be. Osama bin Laden emerged from the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and he went back to Saudi Arabia. We don't know who his equivalent, who the symbol of the jihadis will be from this war. We know that they're already going back. Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, around 250 were of the jihadis were in Iraq and came back. So we're going to have a containment strategy that's designed to ensure the borders aren't porous in and out, so you don't have them going back, jihadis going back, and subverting, destabilizing all the other countries in the region. This means you have to have, when we, the containment strategy obviously has to involve a kind of disengagement, but it also has to involve figuring out how you play upon the interests of all the neighbors. You think that Iran wants Iraq to fall apart? You know, Iran has a population that is 50% Persian. It means it's 50% non-Persian. You think they want fragmentation of Iraq? You think it doesn't create a kind of infection for them that they worry about? Here again, recognize their vulnerabilities, recognize where you have leverage. The Saudis don't want them to fall apart. All of Iraq's neighbors will not agree on what they want for Iran, for Iraq, but they can all agree on what they fear about Iraq. Today, we keep the lid on in Iraq, and we make it safe enough for everybody on the inside and the outside to avoid choice. We have to begin to change that equation so it's not safe enough for them to avoid choice. Bottom line is, containment may not be what we want in Iraq, but it's got to be at least the least bad option we're able to produce. And it has a military component and it has a diplomatic component.
Senator Joe Biden, candidate for president, has his views about a proposal for Iraq. Basically, he's proposing a decentralized government with Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish people in semi-autonomous regions. Would you comment on that, please?
Well, it may be. That's what's also another way to describe what he's suggesting is soft partition. A lot of people were opposed to that approach, soft partition, on the grounds that it required too much ethnic cleansing. But that's before we had a lot of ethnic cleansing. Bear in mind that in Iraq today, the population of Iraq when we went into Iraq was 26 million. There are 4 million out of 26 who have been displaced. Think about that. That is a catastrophic number. 2 million people have left. 2 million people have been displaced. The 4 million who left, either out of the country or out of the neighborhoods, guess what? They've already begun to change the map within Iraq, at least from a sectarian standpoint. You don't have the same kind of mixed neighborhoods. You still have many. I'm not saying they're all gone. But in a sense, you've begun to create soft partition in reality. So it may be that this is the best outcome. You marry this as an option that you focus on. How could you manage such a transition to that while you also keep in reserve the containment option as your ultimate fallback? Bear in mind that basically what we ought to be looking for right now are people talking about what is the outcome in Iraq that we can accept. And I would tell you one other thing. If you ask me where Iraq will be 10 years from now or 15 years from now, we will have a central government in Iraq that has very limited powers. We will have provinces that have very extensive autonomy. We will have some means of sharing revenues. The question has always been, can you create a transition to that point that is manageable and not so brutal and awful that basically it is something that in the end is managed? Or are we going to get to the outcome I described only through a process of complete exhaustion, where in a sense everybody there, after they've bled themselves beyond the point of comprehension, will then say, okay, we'll work that out. The objective should have been all along to manage the transition. I'm afraid, I fear, that the exhaustion option is more likely. I hope it's not too late for that. But that's why I would say soft partition, the way Senator Biden suggested, is a realistic, it seems to me, it is still a realistic objective. Containment is your fallback objective after that.
Well, Dennis Ross, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for just one last question, and that is, if Israel were to magically disappear, would the overall situation in the Middle East be considerably different?
Well, if Israel were to magically disappear, we would be bereft. We would find the region transformed in a way that we will all suffer from. If a democracy disappears, we all lose, number one. Usually when that question is asked is, if the Palestinian issue was no longer an issue, if there was no longer conflict, wouldn't that solve all our problems in the area? And the answer is no. Would it be good to ensure that radical Islamists can't exploit this grievance? You bet. But if tomorrow we didn't have an Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we would still have the problems in Iraq. The insurgency won't go away. The Shia militias won't go away. We'd still have Iraq, and it wouldn't look any different than it does today. Iran would still be pursuing a nuclear weapon. It's not connected to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Osama bin Laden would still be a radical Islamist determined to try to do everything he can, and al-Qaeda to do everything they can to destroy anyone associated with us and what we represent. So would it be a panacea? Absolutely not. You know, just because we've seen an administration whose basic approach has been too faith-based, too ideologically driven, and too simple-minded doesn't mean the equal and opposite approach is what we ought to adopt. That's why I wrote this book. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dennis Ross, fellow at the Washington Institute and former U.S. Special Middle East Coordinator from 1988 to 2000, and author of the book Statecraft, How to Restore America's Standing in the World. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. My name is Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.